Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
And welcome to Tanakh Book of Failure. First of all, thank you to our sponsors for today, for the general program sponsor, which was dedicated in memory for Pesach Ben Avraham Moshe HaKohen, which you'll notice at the bottom of each sheet in your packet, other than the first page, as well as the bottom of the first page, actually, but in a different style. Thank you to the sponsors of my shiur, Dov and Jane Goldberg, who dedicated an appreciation of the wonderful shiurim given by the members of Beit Midrash Sefron Dov. That's very much appreciated. Thank you as well to all of you for coming out at this early hour. The 9 o'clock shiur has never been so well attended. I don't know, that may not be true, but it certainly is well attended today, and thank you as well to Yeshiva Or Chaim. Because I'm one of the Facebook people, shout out to those watching on Facebook, if anybody yet. So, good morning. The first story in Tanakh that we're going to examine today is the story of Achan. To begin, let's start with summarizing as to what actually happens. The way that I've laid out my source sheets, and not everybody has the same style and format, is as follows. What I did on the first two pages is I gave you pasuk by pasuk in the Hebrew and the Koran Jerusalem Bible English translation of the psukim of the story that we will examine. Again, the story of Achan's sin. And you can follow along within the Hebrew or the English if you wish. I'm going to summarize, not by looking in the actual text and reading it out, but actually outside the text. But you're more than welcome to follow along the pasuk citations which I give. And as we go through this year, we will refer back again and again to specific psukim that are in that. So that way you do not need a Tanakh. If you have a Tanakh, you can turn to Yehoshua chapter 7. That's really where we'll be beginning. So 7:1, the first pasuk in Perek Zion of Yehoshua, tells us that the Jews committed some sort of trespass. They did something wrong. They took from the spoils of Jericho. Now, just as a background, is that the Jews have just finished conquering Jericho. They've entered Israel, and they've had this miraculous, miraculous battle at Jericho, where, as we know, the walls fall down, they came tumbling down, and after that, they go into the city. Morale is really very, very high right now. The Jewish people are really thinking, we got this, we're going to go, and we're just going to ravage through, basically, they're thinking, Israel, and capture Canaan, as they had been promised. So after they're done with that, they're now going to approach their second city, really, that they're going to capture after Jericho, the second major city, Ai. Okay, that's where they're up to. One thing that the pasuk has noted repeatedly in advance is that the Jews were warned not to take from the spoils of battle of Jericho. That was to go all to God. And in fact, as we are told, the Jews did not follow this because Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zavdi, the son of Zerah, of Yehuda, actually took from the spoils of Jericho. That's our one verse introduction to chapter 7. And then now we hear the story, the narrative of chapter 7. From 7:2 to 7:6, the Jews go to attack Ai, again, thinking like God's with us, we're going to, again, destroy all these Canaanite cities. And in fact, they actually lose in battle quite heavily to the people of Ai. They have to flee. Their morale is destroyed. 36 people actually die in this attack. So in 7:7 to 7:12, there is a discussion between Yehoshua and God. And Yehoshua's like, what happened? Because again, from the perspective of the Jewish people, they don't know that someone has disobeyed the laws of God. And Yehoshua goes to God and he says, why? You know, you brought us here for what? Why have you made us lose this battle? Which was seemingly an easy battle that they didn't need many men for, if you look at the details of the psukim. And God actually explains that someone has sinned. Then in 7:12 to 7:15, God tells Yehoshua how to identify the sinner and the punishment of the sinner that will be to, unfortunately, burn him and all of his possessions, as we'll see his family as well. In 7:16 to 7:18, which is already on the second page, again, if you're following along in the verses themselves, reading the Hebrew or the English, is Yehoshua carrying out God's process to identify the sinner, to identify the person who had taken from the spoils. And 7:19 through 21 is that Achan is identified, Achan is caught, and he admits his wrongdoing. He actually says, yes, I did do this, I did this wrong, I did that wrong, I took from here, I took from there. If you want to look at actually what he takes, I mean, we can go with the translation that we have in front of us in verse 21. When I saw among the spoil a goodly mantle of shinar and 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels weight, and I coveted them and took them, and behold, they are hid in the earth in the midst of my tent, and the silver under it. And that's really what Achan has done. He's taken all this valuable stuff for himself, and he's hidden it in his own tent. After that, in 722 to 23, Yoshua confirms the wrongdoing by checking up to see if that's in fact in Achan's tent. It is. And he either places or melts them in front of God. And finally, 724 to 26, Yoshua and the entire nation burn and stone Achan and all of his family and possessions, and they leave it there as a sign and a memorial almost to say, don't do this again. And that's really the story of Achan contained in chapter 7 of Sefer Yehoshua. One thing I wanted to note is to go back and think of the initial discovery that someone has done wrong. How did that come about? That happened when they lost, again, quite badly in their battle with the people of Ai. And if we look back, it's true that, yes, they had to flee because of them. And it's true that 36 people die. And it's true that, the morale of the people was greatly, greatly diminished by this loss to such a weak nation. But it really, truly could have been a lot worse than that. If you're thinking of an attack force of a few thousand people, which is how many people went to attack Ai, 36 casualties, as terrible as that is, especially under the circumstances that they were entering Ai, again, being on a high from capturing Yericho, it could have been a lot worse. That's, I think, one thing that we can look at the Pesukim and say, 36 people is bad, but it's not 1,000 people, and the entire Jewish nation wasn't defeated. But the truth is, the Gemara tells us, the Talmud tells us in source number 2, which is likely referring to this story, even though the words Bein Beit El Ubein Ha'ai are actually discussed in the next time they go to battle against Ai. The Talmud tells us in source number 2 in Sanhedrin 44b, Amar Rabbi Elazar said, Le'olam yakdim adam tfila letzara. One should always pray before the trouble or misfortune arrives. She'ilmalei yakdim Avraham tfila letzara, bein beit el, ubein ha'ai, had Avraham Avinu, who himself was traveling in this area, not prayed between Beit El and Ai, again, Ai being the city which they were looking to attack now, if not for Avraham's prayer, says the Gemara, lo nishtayer misoneihen shel Yisrael saridu falit. There would be not left one survivor from Israel. The Gemara itself actually says the enemies of Israel. It's a common term which is used to, when you don't want to say a bad thing about Bnei Israel, you say the enemies of Israel would have been destroyed. And basically what the Gemara is telling us is, if not for this prayer that took place hundreds of years beforehand by Abraham in the same location, this would have actually been a lot worse. Bnei Israel might have been defeated altogether at Ai. They may have been completely killed. And this would have been the end of everything if not for the prayer of Abraham. And I'm not looking so much to explore that Gemara as to really think about a really bothersome question. And there's plenty of seats up front here, as well as the sides. And that question is, okay, it's bad. Someone took from the spoils of Yericho. I got that. But we're saying it's that bad that the entire Jewish nation would have been worthy of being killed if not for the prayer of Abraham some few hundred or thousand years before? Is it really that bad? And more importantly, the major question, which I'm really trying to emphasize, is why would the entire nation have deserved it? It's one thing, again, if a sinner does a sin and they are held responsible and they are held culpable. But it's another thing to hold 36 innocent people who have now died because of the sin of someone, a hidden sin of someone. And not only that, we're saying the entire Jewish nation would have been worthy of being destroyed. Isn't that a bit of a problem? And really, that's one of the questions that Ralbag asks. If you look at Ralbag at the beginning of this chapter, and it's important, again, to reference back to the Pesukim here. If you turn back to page 1 to your virtual Tanakh or your printed Tanakh here in chapter 7, it says, if you look at the language used, Vayimalu b'nei Yisrael ma'al b'cherem. The Jewish people committed some sort of trespass in regards to devoted property. And then Vayikach Achan. But it refers to the sin as belonging to whom? The Jewish people as a whole. And Ralbag asks, and we'll read it inside in the English, in source number 3, it tells of how the Jewish people took from the spoils, and it explains that this trespass was that Achan had already taken up from the spoils, and because of this sin, great anger came upon the Jewish people, and that 36 people died in battle with the inhabitants of the city of Ai. And says Ralbag exactly what we've asked. One can question and say, how is it possible in this system, the godly legal system, as ethical and moral as it's supposed to be, that the Jewish people be punished for the sin of Achan? The Torah has already stated, and he makes reference back to a pasuk which we will deal with a little bit later, right at the end of this year, it's Devarim 24:16, that ish becheto yumasu, people are put to death only for their own sins and not for others. So how is it that one sin by one man caused the destruction of 36 people, in addition to the fact that we're saying it might even have been worse? So there's a classic answer, and I'd like to explore that classic answer briefly and to see how it holds up. That answer is found in Metzudat David here. It's found in 7.1. It's found, I believe, in other psukim as well. I didn't quote all of the different instances where he repeats this because the message and idea is the same in all places. If you take a look at source number 4, Bayim Alu V'Hulei, why, and he's asking again, why does it refer to the Jewish people as a whole? Why doesn't it say Vayim Al Achan Becherim? Why does it say Vayim Alu B'nei Israel? So says Metzudat David, Al Shelosh Shamru Zeh Et Zeh. Since they didn't guard one another, they didn't stop Achan from pulling this off. Ma'ale alehem hakatuv ki'ilu kulam ma'alu. And he's explaining the language of the verse. So he says, therefore, the verse considers it as if all the Jewish people had sinned. What that also means is that therefore God considered it that all the Jewish people had sinned, and that that's why those 36 sort of innocent people were killed, says Metzudot, because they weren't innocent. It was upon them to make sure that no one takes from the spoils of Yericho, and from the fact that they did not prevent Achan from carrying out this act, they are, so to say, responsible, and they are not actually innocent. Therefore, the pasuk considers as if they themselves took because they allowed it to happen. One might even say enabled it to happen, because had they stopped him, this terrible sin would never have happened and people would not have been lost. And therefore, it's almost justifiable for God to kill people who were not actually involved in the action of the sin themselves. That's the way he tends to look at this. And the truth is, this really extends really, really far. If you look at the way he applies it, we'll jump now back again to the text. If you look at Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11, again, in source number 1 in our virtual Tanakh here, if you look at the language that God uses when he's telling Yehoshua what happened, we'll read the Hebrew, Chata Yisrael, Israel has sinned, Vigam Avruet Briti, and they've also transgressed my covenant, Asher Tziviti Otam, which I commanded them, that was again warning them not to take from the spoils, Vigam Lachumi Acherim, and they've also taken of the devoted property, Vigam Ganvu, they've also stolen, Vigam Kichashu, and they have denied, Vigam Samu Bithlehem, and they've put it among their own vessels. And this is the way that Hashem describes the sin of the Jewish people. Again, not one mention of an individual. It's as if the entire Jewish people, says God, have sinned, have broken my covenant, have all taken from the spoils, have all stolen, have all denied it, and have all put it in their own vessels. And Metzudat David actually would be forced to say, and as he explains each of these details as to what they actually mean and why they are worse, has to admit that the fact that the Jewish people did not stop this from happening makes them culpable for each of these additional details. And let's take a look at how he explains these details, which will lead us to question his overall idea. He says, Vigam ganvu. What does it mean to stole? What he explains is, ilu lachule in kol, had they taken it publicly, had the Jewish people just gone in and marched in broad daylight, hayu al kol panim mashvim kavod hamakom lichvod basar v'adam, he says, at the very least, they would have treated God with the respect of at least a human. Meaning, we tend not to go up to people, I don't walk over to any of you and steal your possessions while I'm standing right up here in front of people and on Facebook. Instead, what you would do is you'd at the very least be afraid of them. You'd sneak in at night if you wanted to steal something. Not that that's a good idea, but that's the way you tend to treat other people. You're fearful of them. However, what the Jewish people did, says Metzudat David here, is that they actually, they were worried about people and they weren't worried about God. Because when it comes to God, God can see us always. And it would have been worthy that just like I wouldn't walk right in front of you now and steal your stuff, I should never steal because God is always watching. But what they did is they said, no, we're going to actually do this hiddenly. We're going to do this quietly without people knowing, but it doesn't matter if God knows. So God is essentially rebuking them and saying, at least have as much honor for me as for people. Don't steal it right in front of my face, right under my nose. Or at the very least, if you're going to steal, at least steal it in front of people as well. Why are you more afraid of people than you are afraid of me? And he also said, they also denied it. And again, he quotes a verse in Mishlei to say that people do not despise a thief if he steals, and if afterwards he would repent, regret, return it. But you guys did not repent when there was a terrible, again, loss in battle. No one came forward and said, I'm really sorry I stole. We had to go through this whole system of identifying the sinner in the way that God mentioned in order to find out who it was. And finally, v'gam samu b'chleihem, he notes again, based on the verse in Mishlei, that it's one thing if I need food and I'm hungry and I steal, but to take it back and for me to just put things away and to take things which I don't need is even worse than that. And what we see is, in addition to his explanation as to why each of these levels is worse and worse and worse than we might have originally thought, we're forced to admit that the fact that the Jewish people did not stop this sin from happening is that in his view, they're responsible not only for the fact that someone took, they're also responsible for the fact that it was taken in a hidden manner. That seems a little bit bizarre. We're saying in one breath that they are responsible for this act, but that also was performed in a way that they couldn't know. That sounds a little bit funny. We're also saying that because they didn't stop this from happening, they're going to be responsible for denying it. Again, hard to know. Just because they didn't stop it, are we saying that they are denying it? And again, v'gam samu b'chleihem, we're also going to say because they didn't stop it, that it's as if they each took it home for their own storehouses. So you see, even though in the first place you say it's not so crazy to say you should have stopped the person, therefore you're held responsible for your actions, but we see that the way Hashem is holding everybody responsible is to a degree that's very, very great, as if they had each performed each of these terrible acts on their own. And why is that? The truth is, the biggest question of all this that we mentioned is that it's one thing to hold people responsible for something they could have done something about. But as we've seen, Achan says what? I've done this in a hidden manner. No one was aware of it. This, I've snuck it into my tent. And you can see that in the pasuk that we just read. You can see it as well when Achan talks about in pasuk 21, which we read. At the end of the verse, and again on page 4 of the source packet, he says, they're hidden in the earth. It's very clear that not everybody could have known about this. So in addition to the fact that we're holding other people responsible for his sin, we have another question, which is, even if we are to answer that they are responsible because they didn't stop it, was that really something that they were able to do? We all know the Torah tells us, Hanistarot l'Hashem Elokeinu. If something is a hidden sin, if someone in their own house goes and does something wrong that I can have no ability to influence in any form or fashion, that's not my responsibility. I can't be held accountable for something that I can't stop. So why is it again in this case, even if we were to answer that people should have stopped him, we have to explain how that could be. How could they have actually stopped Achan if people weren't aware of this, if this was done in the dead of the night and hidden away? And the Gemara actually asks this question and gives one answer that's not really going to solve our other question. The Gemara answers, Achan asks, Achan maitama I anush. What is the reason, we're going to read the translation here, we're in source number 6, that in the case of Achan, they were punished. Ask the Gemara, why is there a punishment in the case of Achan? And the Gemara answers, Mishum dehavu yadi bei ishto uvanav. The Gemara says, I'll tell you why. Because his wife and children knew what he did, presumably, and they could have stopped him. So why? Well, as Rashi notes, why should the Jewish people have been punished on it? Because it was min hanistarot in source number 7. This was a hidden sin. Nevertheless, the Gemara answers, because it's true it was hidden, but it wasn't hidden from everybody. His family and maybe his close ring of friends, they knew about it. So on the one hand, it's true that does explain how people would have been expected to stop it, but it doesn't explain why, again, our 36 innocent people were killed as a result of this sin. So we seem to be stuck. On the one hand, where if we want to say that people are to blame for it, we can't figure out why they're to blame. And if we want to say that people, that only his family were to blame for it, we can't understand why all these other innocent people were killed. And so for that, I'd like to look to another story in Sefer Yehoshua to try to figure out perhaps an interpretation of why God's anger flares against these 36 people who seemingly could not have done anything to prevent the sin of Achan, and reflect back on this story and that story to see if there's a lesson that we can take from this. And for this, I gave you only the English translation. Again, it's from the Current Jerusalem Bible. It's source number 8. So after Reuven, Gad, and half of the tribe of Menashe, who had agreed back in the Torah at the end of Sefer Bamidbar with Moshe, that although they wanted to live in Transjordan and not to cross over and receive a portion of the land of Canaan, they felt they could just live back before where they had crossed. Moshe had told them that, no, you need to come along and fight alongside the other tribes to capture the land of Israel, and only then may you return home. And what happens at that point is, after Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe fulfilled this deal to its entirety, that's where we pick up in chapter 22. And we'll read from verse 7. Now to the one half of the tribe of Menashe, we're in source number 8. Moshe had given possession in Bashan, but to the other half of it, Yehoshua had given territory among their brethren on this side of the Jordan westward. Moreover, when Yehoshua sent them away to their tents, he blessed them. And this is Yehoshua sending away the people from the battle. And he spoke to them, saying, return with much riches to your tents, and with very much cattle and silver, and with gold, and with copper, with iron, and with very many garments. Divide the spoil of your enemies with your brothers. And so the children of Reuven and the children of Gad and half tribe of Manasseh returned and departed from the children of Israel out of Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, to go to the country of Gilad, which will actually be a focus in our next shiur that we're going to have about Yiftach, to the land of their possession, of which they were possessed according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moshe. So are Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh leaving on good terms or bad terms? Wonderful terms. Yehoshua is blessing them and saying, great job, guys. Thank you so much. Go back with riches. Go in peace. Everything seems to be good. They have been exceptional in fulfilling their word toward to God, to Moshe, that they would help the Jews conquer the land of Israel, and now they are allowed to go home. So they go home. And let's read verse 10, where all the drama starts. And when they came to the districts of the Jordan that are in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuven and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built there an altar by the Jordan, a great and conspicuous altar. Now, at this point, we had a Mishkan set up. It was not allowed to build altars outside of where the Mishkan was set. And they have just now gone outside of Israel and built a giant altar. And the children of Israel say back in verse 11, as we're about to turn page 5 onto page 6, behold, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar over against the land of Canaan in the districts of the Jordan on the side of the children of Israel. And when the children of Israel heard of it, meaning now the rest of the tribes, the other 9.5 tribes that are in the land of Canaan proper, when they heard about this, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered themselves together at Shiloh to go up to war against them. And the children of Israel sent to the children of Reuben, to the children of Gad, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, and to the land of Gilad, Pinchas, son of Elazar the priest, and with him 10 princes of each chief house, a prince, throughout all the tribes of Israel. And basically they send Pinchas, and they send these leaders of the tribes to say, what is going on? You were on our side. You just helped us conquer the land of Israel. And the first thing you do when you get back over to your land is build something that God despises, that God has not allowed you to build. Are you splitting up from us? What happened? And they were ready to war against these 2.5 tribes. And if you read through the next verses where there's a discussion, where they basically begin to rebuke Pinchas and these, again, these heads of the tribes, go in to talk to them and say, why are you doing this? God's going to kill all of us. And that's something they emphasize. Verse 18. But that you must turn away this day from following the Lord. And it will be, if you rebel today against the Lord, that tomorrow he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. Howbeit, if the land of your possession be unclean, then pass over to the land of possession of the Lord, where the Lord's tabernacle dwells, and take possession among us, but rebel not against the Lord, nor rebel against us, in building an altar for yourselves besides the altar of the Lord of God. And they rebuke them. And they say, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? If it's that you feel bad that you don't have a portion in Israel, so fine, come over. We'll make you a portion in Israel. But why are you rebelling against God now? Don't do that. And what's the comparable for this? A very bizarre comparable look in source number 9. Hello, Achan ben Zerach Ma'al, Ma'al Bachemrim, Valkol Adat Yisrael Hayaketef, Vu Ish Echad Lo Gava Ba'avono. And they say, this is like the sin of Achan. Achan was alone in his sin, and it wasn't just him who perished. I think the comparison here and the message here is to say, no matter how distinct you think a particular group may be, no matter how much you might be able to say, I'm for myself, my family is for myself, my people are for myself, that's not going to happen. The Jewish people are a single unit and they are indivisible. And therefore, when Reuven and Gad and Menashe, even though they're in a completely different geographical location now, when they sin, the entire Jewish people will be held responsible. And that's why they respond so harshly. God's not just going to go through Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe and have anger against them for doing something wrong. It's going to go against everybody, even though they are now split off. And by the way, the end of that story is that the altar was totally fine. The altar was a monument to remember that they were actually part of Israel, and therefore they built that altar. But the point is to say that even if it's a group of people that sin, God treats the entire B'nai Yisrael as one unit. And that's exactly the way Malbim, in source number 10, explains our story in Yehoshua. And he says this teaches that the entire Jewish people are tied together as one body, to the point that each individual's relationship to the whole is a relationship of one limb of the body to the entire body. And just as though, I should say, illness or loss within one limb will cause illness or damage to the entire body, so too, when Achan took from the spoils, it was considered as if the entire nation took. And this is what it meant by, but the children of Israel committed a trespass. What the lesson of the Malbim is, what the lesson of the story of Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe building an altar is that when B'nai Yisrael are together, one person sinning, as sad as that may be, is actually the entire nation sinning. We cannot say it was only that individual who sinned and therefore should get punished. We cannot say it was only that family who sinned and they should get punished. We cannot say it's only that tribe who sinned and should get punished. We cannot say it's only that country that sinned and should get punished. God views us as one big unit. And that is the reason for a number of different emphases in the stories. It's the reason for all of the B'nai Yisrael, A, being accused of the sin. Because again, when one person in Israel does it, we're all part of that same group. We've all done it. Not because we should have prevented that from happening. But since we did sin, it's upon us now to repair our sin. And that was the case with Achan. That was the case with Reuven, Gad, and Menashe. And really, that's why B'nai Yisrael are present for the entire punishment of Achan and his family. And if you come to ask me, well, is that really fair? Is that really ethical? And isn't that, as the Rabbag asked, against the Torah, where we say, Ish bechet oyumasu, that a person is only put to death for their own sins? And for that, we have source number 11, the last source within the last couple of minutes here in the Shir. Rashbam explains on that verse that that's only in human hands. In a court of law of people, that's when we have to only take into account what an individual has wronged. It's not for us to judge the entire Jewish people and kill someone else because of what happened. But God, explains Rashbam, does in fact visit guilt of parents upon their children. And as tough as that may be, it's because of this idea that B'nai Israel are one. There has to be one big body. And each of us are part of that body. And therefore, if one of us sins, unfortunately, there can be a tremendous failure for the entire people. That being said, it's not because we all failed in stopping Achan that we are held responsible according to this view, but rather because Achan committed the sin, it is a responsibility on us to stop him in advance or afterwards so that we do not all sin. I'll take one quick question and we'll move on to the next year.
So the story of Shaul Amalek. Right?
There will be someone speaking about that today, so I can't get into that part as well. Just because we're at time here, I'm going to ask that any questions, I would be happy to talk after my next shiur, but we have a schedule to stick to, I'm sorry. You can also email me if you're not going to be around after I'm done my next year, and I'll be more than happy to take your questions. But thank you very, very much for shiur one.